This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on May 15th, 2016. This week, Paul Jaisley, Nick White, and our host Mike Rappin talk all ages comics, what all ages means, what it should mean, and the fundamentals of all ages comics. They also discuss some of their favorite all ages titles. And now, this week's episode.
This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two amazing human beings who I love to talk about comic books with, Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey.
Thank you guys for joining me. This is going to be a fantastic episode, mostly because I got two emails from a guy named Zach, who's written into the show to talk about some stuff that we normally don't talk about on our show. So I wrote him a couple emails, but I want to thank Zach for writing into us. That's amazing. We want everyone to write in and talk to us about comic books. And eventually, maybe we might turn some of those letters into actual episodes where we talk about them, you know, among the group of two or three people that are on that episode. So thank you, Zach, so much for writing in, and we look forward to more letters from you in the future. But before we actually get into what we read this week and our comic picks, Paul and Nick and I want to talk about Darwin Cook, who just recently passed away. So, Paul, if you want to take it from here.
Yeah, sure. I have to say that I was surprised how emotionally affected I was when I heard the news about Darwin Cook. This is Friday, early afternoon Friday, when the sort of word got out that he was seeking care for some fairly aggressive cancer. And then the outpouring, absolutely overwhelming at times, outpouring of support and love from comic book creators, fans across the internet, just saying how much they enjoyed his work. And then, of course, the next day on Saturday, the word came that he'd actually passed away early Saturday morning. And it's interesting. I was surprised how much it affected me, and I was surprised how much people were sharing similar images and remembrances and comments about Darwin Cook. For our, you know, comic books are such a subjective art form, but everyone liked his work, which I think says a lot. I mean, everyone reacted to his work in a different way, and his work was so varied. I mean, he was able to do a book like New Frontier, which is a DC comic book about DC superheroes, but it certainly didn't feel like a mainstream superhero book, and I think that's why it's so beloved. When you saw him draw Superman, it wasn't just here's the character that you recognize. He was like drawing the inherent wholesomeness and goodness of the character at the same time. And that's why his artwork really affected people. And then his like books like Parker, he's playing with the art form and the medium in these amazing ways. So sort of final thought I've had in my mind since then is I've gone back and I've read some of his stuff. And what stuck out to me is his craft as a storyteller, which is hard to pick a single image and share online, say, this is what I like. But I'm reading stuff like Selena's Big Score or Parker or some of the Batman stuff he did. The page-to-page layouts, the panel-to-panel transitions are amazing. The stuff that when it works well, you don't notice, he was a master at. And I think that's the stuff people are going to be studying in his artwork for decades to come.
Totally. Totally. Nick, do you have any words to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, Paul covered it pretty well, but that being said, I'll be more than glad to retread on a couple of those points.
Yeah.
this was a big shock. Paul's absolutely right. I was sitting down for lunch after work on Friday, and then all of a sudden my Twitter feed was just getting kind of bombarded. And it's not surprising because a lot of the people that I follow on Twitter have worked with Darwin Cook quite a bit in the past, and I think we were just really shocked how quickly all of this happened. And then I went into work Friday night, got home, went to check my phone right before going to bed, and found out that he had passed. And this is a great loss. I mean, I'm not telling anybody anything they don't already know, but I mean, Darwin Cook, his art was just so instantly identifiable, and I think every artist sort of dreams or has nightmares over the idea that people can automatically see their art, pick it out, and know that it's that person. But I mean, for Darwin Cook, that was a good thing. I think his style was just so wholly individual. And I think especially in this modern day and age, where comics have gotten so gritty, every character has 19 of their own personal problems they're dealing with, and they've got no reason to be upbeat or happy or joyous, mm-hmm. or, you know, they feel that, you know, being a superhero is full of, you know, pathos and dreariness. And Cook's characters were always, you know, always smiling and always happy to help, and even Batman smiled for the most part, mm-hmm. which was a rare thing to actually encounter. So we're gonna miss that. Just amazing artist, and I think Paul hit the nail right on the head when he said that people sort of forget that despite being such an amazing, definitive, singular, you know, unique artist, his storytelling craft was just right up there with his actual artistry. And things are not going to be the same. There's no one else really like him. I think the closest thing, and maybe consciously or subconsciously, that's why I sort of clung to this stuff this week in addition to his, was like, you know, Doc Shaner for me, mm-hmm. is maybe as close as you're going to get. Paolo Rivera, same sort of thing, just this mm-hmm. colorful, clean drawing style that's kind of full of adventure and optimism that you just don't find anymore. And I miss that. And we're going to miss that.
Definitely. Totally. And I mean, obviously, passing away at 53 that's far, far too young. Yep. Especially, it's looking like his final work is going to be The Twilight Children, the book that he did with Gilbert Hernandez, which I absolutely loved because it was those two guys working together. Mm-hmm. Going back and looking through the issues over the past like day or so, I was just struck by how much Darwin Cook was changing his style. It's not like Parker. It's not like the New Frontier. He's actively channeling Gilbert Hernandez's style. And it was amazing to see someone, like you said, Nick, with such a unique style, but was still constantly innovating and experimenting with his artwork to try new things out. And I think Twilight Children is a book, if you haven't read, go buy it right now. It's one of these books that's going to have a critical reevaluation, I think, unfortunately, for, you know, some unfortunate circumstances now, but it is going to be one of his masterworks. I remembered as such for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally.
And
totally.
Maybe it's too soon to be wondering about this, or maybe I'm just being greedy because I want more of his work, but I am curious whether or not we'll ever get to see any of that series he was working on for Image.
Right.
And you know what's kind of interesting is, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, I think that series was being solicited and promoted maybe over like half a year ago, even maybe mm-hmm. even longer. And then I didn't even think about it at the time, but you just stopped hearing anything. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was partially Twilight Children, but otherwise maybe you have to wonder if he was already sort of, you know, I don't know.
But, right. Maybe well, we'll get what to blows my mind that. Is this, you know, the disease, like, or the cancer that he had, like, must have been affecting him all throughout Twilight Children. And the fact that no one knew that, like, they still put out this amazing book. Like, I read that book on your suggestion, Paul, and I loved it. It astounds me. Like, that guy was a fighter, I think, until, like, the very last moments of everything. You know, I mean, the last issue of Twilight Children came out in late January. So, like, it blows my mind. Like, that guy was still able to create magnificent work despite, you know, everything else that was happening in his life. So I'm kind of bummed that, like, my introduction to Darwin Cook has only been, you know, reading Parker in the last year and, you know, grabbing some variant covers from when DC did, you know, the Darwin Cook variant covers.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
I like, want to go back and reread a bunch of his stuff, which is why I grabbed as much as I could on that. That, you know, there was a Comixology sale that I think coincidentally lined up. Who knows?
Yeah.
But still, like, I grabbed as much as I could because I want to read this guy's work. If I can help his family in one way or another, if that means, like, buying comics so that they'll get money, like, so be it. I'll definitely be trying to do that. But, yeah, it's a huge loss.
Absolutely. But, you know, anytime something like this happens, and 2016 so far has been a year full of, you know, losing geniuses far too young. Yes. But I mean, the artwork remains. I mean, we're still going to have these books to read forever. And we're, like I said, people are going to be finding new things in them constantly. So mm-hmm. I know that his family, you know, requested that people wanted to help out, they can donate to the Hero Initiative, which is something we've talked about on the show before. So if you've considered making a donation, this is probably a really good time to do so. To that cause.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Let's move forward.
Yeah.
You know, as we should do, you know. We shouldn't dwell on these things for too long. But so let's talk about what we've read recently. I know it's been like a crazy week for everyone, but you know, I think we all managed to sit down and read some comic books. So Nick, what did you enjoy this past week that you read?
Well, as I said earlier, consciously or subconsciously, and even some of this was being read before I heard about Darwin Cook, I started out by reading some of the Flash Gordon series by Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner and Jordi Belair. And, you know, what I love about this book is the more and more I get excited about it, I realize that Future Quest is right around the corner. and so it's not like once I finish this book up, it's like, well, we're never going to have that team ever again. But gosh, Flash Gordon, the art is so neat and so clean and the colors pop out. And just like I was saying about Cook stuff, again, this stuff is just adventurous. It's fun. It's not too weighed down with personal problems or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything else that I love about it, the sum ups at the beginning of every issue of what happened to the issue before, they're just absolutely hilarious. They're just so funny. I love that book a lot.
It's a very, very good book. I just want to say, I absolutely love that book. I couldn't care less about Flash Gordon as a character, but Jeff Parker, I'll read pretty much anything by Jeff Parker, but I mean, somehow him and Doc Shaner have developed this amazing sort of collaboration that I'll buy anything that they do, whether I like the character or not. They could write an X-Men book, Mike, and I would go buy it.
Oh, man. I mean, calm down, Paul. I don't think you're thinking straight at this point. Yeah. But we're going to cut to a commercial break. Yeah. Paul's clearly lost it. No. I think you're absolutely right, because I'm right there with you. In terms of my Flash Gordon knowledge going into this book, it was... I think he's an American jock who goes into space and shoots things, like, right? And punches things.
I don't know.
And basically, based on the first issue, it's like, here's what you need to know about Flash Gordon. He's in space. He's a, you know, a thrill-seeking idiot. And he likes punching and shooting things. And I was like, well, all right, at least we're on the same page. and I was like, okay. Hellboy and the BPRD 3, actually a little bit underwhelming for me. And in a weird way, the issue spent a good amount of time attempting to set up another series or another arc, which these Hellboy books really aren't known for doing, even though this is the last issue, 3 out of 3 for BPRD 53. But, you know, Paola Rivera art is wonderful, and I'll take it however I can get it. So complaints there. Other than that, I finally read the paybacks, just as you recommended. I finally got around to reading the paybacks, and I practically read that thing cover to cover, which is almost always a, you know, sign of something being, you know, pretty freaking high quality. So I enjoyed that a lot. I think it's really, really weird that it's moving to heavy metal, which got a lot of worries about what that means in terms of how I'm going to get my hands on that, and more importantly, how much is it going to cost me to get my hands on that?
I'm in the same boat.
I also don't know if heavy metal is in the industry of putting this book into a trade paperback, so who knows how this is going to happen.
Well, one thing I can say is if you reach out to Donnie Cates on Twitter, he is really, really responsive. Okay. So I mean, you could always just ask him. He's very good at, I mean, I think you have a private account, Nick, so I don't know, but I reached out to him before, and he's been super cool and really approachable at cons as well.
I just hope, like, you tell me all of this and then I like ask and he's just like, fuck off. I'm like, okay. But my big focus for this week, or probably another one of Nick's, I'm actually surprised it wasn't total shit books. These do come around every once in a while, and yes, I do have a little set of stickers that I, you know, distribute when I go back to the store to put on all the covers of the other, you know, volumes. You know, it's a big sticker because that's a lot of words, and
we're gonna start a Patreon so that Nick can get these actual stickers and put them on comic books.
Vault of Midnight's like, don't ever come back with those ever again.
We'll also have a list of all the book or the comic book shops that Nick is banned from because of this. So it's gonna be a fun game, 2016, late 2016.
These are definitely those stickers that you start peeling from one end, and then you start seeing the stickers staying, and then you start peeling from the other end, and you're like, well, fuck it. And then you know, these are high grade or low grade. I don't know what you would call those. I'm not an expert in stickers, so but Star Volume 1 would definitely be deserving of one of these stickers. It's from Brian Wood, which if you know anything about Brian Wood, you know that he's, well, I'll be blunt, he can be a bit of a crapshoot. Not everything is solid gold. And, I mean, he's human, so I guess not everything needs to be. But Starve is an Image series from him. It's got Dave Stewart on colors, and I'm going to totally butcher this guy's name, but it's like Daniel Zigili. I'm sure that's not even remotely close on art. And it's this really interesting story of a world that is maybe a couple baby steps towards Brian Woods. What's that series? The Massive. It's a couple baby steps towards the Massive in terms of global warming is definitely worse than it was. Cities are somewhat underwater and things like that, but it's not like people are, you know, bludgeoning each other over the head for Slim Jims or anything. You know, it's not that level of desperation yet. And this cook named Gordon Cruikshank, I believe, he sort of ends up going on a self-imposed exile for a while, and he gets dragged back in. He had created this really crazy, super popular TV reality show called Starve, and it was obviously something not along the lines of what Chopped, cooking competition show. Sure. And he gets dragged back in due to this whole contractual, you know, well, here's a nice loophole, and it's the whole drag me back in again trope, but whatever. And it's an interesting story because he's brought back in as a contestant on his show and basically sort of set up to fail. But in this kind of post-apocalyptic state, it's like this weird thing where they're having to cook all of these rare and endangered foods where, like, most of them don't even exist anymore. Or, like, they're having to cook, like, bluefish tuna for one of their challenges. And because the environment is so shitty, it's, like, it's totally impossible to find one that's even, like that exists. And so that's part of the challenge is finding this thing. Or there are parts where they have, like, kitchen battles where they're sent to different parts of the town and they have to, like, fight back, like, the kitchen's, like, crew and chef to, like, take control of the kitchen to cook there for the chance. It's weird. It's all sorts of, like, dystopian, like, super rich meets, like, super poor kind of things. And then all the while, in the meantime, he's dealing with the fact that, like, his grown daughter is trying to, you know, connect with him again, but the wife is basically trying to steal all of his money, and also reconciling the fact that, like, his family is sort of mad at him because he, you know, he got married and had a kid, but at, like, 40 or so, he's, like, 55 in this, he came out as gay and sort of divorced his wife and kind of abandoned the family, and it's interesting. I can't do this book justice because it's, like, levels of insanity in all sorts of directions that somehow come together. It's a $9.99 Image first volume. Really interesting. If you have any interest in, like, cooking, there are, like, recipes, and clearly he must have consulted with a lot of chefs for this, or he has some pretty great knowledge himself. But really interesting, like, black market, like, the black market of food is a big part of this as well. I don't know. It's it's really interesting. Yeah.
Cool, man. Now I have to try this book. Thanks, Nick.
Yeah. I can't do it justice. It's weird in so many ways, but they all work together pretty well.
Cool, man. Paul, what'd you read this week?
Well, I didn't read a whole lot. Unfortunately, I had a very busy couple weeks. I was so busy, in fact, that I actually missed Free Comic Book Day altogether. So,
oh, man.
I know. I was on my way to Chicago. By the time I got to Chicago, I went to one of my favorite comic book stores, Quimby's, but all the stuff they were giving away was gone. So,
Well, to be fair, I mean, tell the audience, Paul, what you decided to do instead of Free Comic Book Day, because I think a lot of people would consider that to be a more than understandable sacrifice.
Right. I mean, I did go to Chicago to see professional wrestling. I saw Ring of Honor and New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Okay.
Global Wars pay-per-view. That was a lot of fun. And I was at Quimby's, which I mentioned is one of my favorite comic book shops. They specialize in, like, mini comics and zines and self-published small press stuff.
That place rules, man. I love that place.
Great shop, and I always try to grab something different. I found some pro wrestling fanzines there, so I was happy.
Nice.
Other than that, again, I've been very busy. I managed to squeeze a few things in. I made it to the public library. I'm trying to make that a habit again. Every Sunday, go read books for free, you know, stealing right out of the creators, you know, pockets and go get my books for free.
Not actually.
I read a few things from the library. I read Civil War, the 2006 7-issue miniseries. I just read the main series by Mark Miller and Stephen McNiven. Obviously, I knew all the details of the comic before I read it, but I was just sort of reading it because I enjoyed the movie. I'm like, oh, I might as well just read the comic. And yeah, Mark Miller's not quite my cup of tea, to put it bluntly. I don't understand.
No way. How is that possible?
go figure.
That's not possible.
And neither, it turns out, is Stephen McNiven. Our record was really not my thing, but not for me, but it still was an enjoyable read. I didn't regret reading it. I finished the whole thing, so I was surprised how quickly I was able to breeze through it, though.
Yeah. Mark Miller scripts typically have, like, you know, 10 to 15 words per issue, so it's not bad.
Yeah.
I also want to point out to our listeners for those who are interested in Civil War, it actually is on Netflix. It's by Ken Burns, but just ignore that fact. You'll have a great time. It's might be confused.
Very different from the comic. I'm not sure why they made those creative choices. But.
Right. They really just reinvented Mark Miller's work on it. They turned it on its head and turned it into a period piece, the likes of which, I mean, you'll be confused, but, like, stick it out. It's only, like, another 16 hours in. So, PBS, you're welcome.
Yeah. So, after Civil War, I read Two Brothers, the OGN, the original graphic novel from Vertigo. I think it came out early last year, or maybe 2014.
Early last year.
Okay. Gabriel Ba and Fabio Moon. I really like those guys a lot. I'd read their previous collaboration from Vertigo, Day Tripper, which was fantastic. I know they worked with Matt Fraction on a lot of the Casanova stuff, so I knew their artwork. And Two Brothers is an adaptation of a novel by a Brazilian author whose name is escaping me. Milton Houghton. There we go. I found it. Milton Houghton. And it's a book about twin brothers that grow up in this coastal town in Brazil. And it's like a Rashomon sort of telling of their life, where each family member is explaining their falling out between the brothers and the eventual reunion and another falling out between the brothers. It's a beautiful book. It's so easy to read yet dense at the same time. And I really like the way that Ba and Moon use black and white in this book. It's a black and white book, lots of heavy inks in it, and the way they use shadows to illustrate things and the way that they stage the characters and the dialogue, it's a very, very beautiful book. Unfortunately, I don't think the novel has been translated into English, and I don't read Portuguese, but I'd be fascinated to see how they translated this into the visual storytelling that they do, because it is a very dense book, even though it's very easy to read, if that makes any sense at all.
I've heard great things about this book.
Yeah, very, very good. So highly recommend that. And then sort of the chance I took at the library, grabbing stuff on a whim, I grabbed a couple of books by the cartoonist Lucy Nisley. It's K-N-I-S-L-E-Y, so I think I'm saying that right. She's kind of well known for her book Relish, which was like an autobiographical comic about being a foodie. This got a lot of like mainstream press and was pretty popular when it came out, but her follow-up book is called An Age of License, and that's the one I grabbed, and it's like a travelogue, basically. It's her going on a tour of Europe to promote the book Relish. And
interesting.
That's really weirdly meta. Wow.
Yeah.
It's a book about my book.
Exactly. But it's less like a diary and more just like the way that she illustrates it and the way it's organized. It's almost as if she's drawing it as it's happening. Like it's reportage in a way. It's like journalism in a way.
Mm.
And her illustration style is cartoony, but it's beautiful at the same time. It's just very effortless the way she draws. And she interrupts the story by just doing these beautiful watercolors of the people that she was with and sketches of the landscapes of across Europe that she went to. A lot of autobiographical comics like this can come off like just illustrated prose, where it's just, here's what I did, and here's just drawings of the things I saw. And that's not a put down. I mean,
that's the way they come off. Yeah.
I was so enamored with this book. I just loved her illustration style, and I liked the way that she was able to kind of put the reader in that place with her. It didn't feel like, here's what I remember happening. It's like, well, here's what happened. Here it is, as it's going on. Fantastic book. I highly recommend it. I was just very... It was a book that I got from the library, and I just sat down and started flipping through the pages and started reading it, and ended up getting about halfway through the book without even realizing it. You know, I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying this. I kind of lost myself in it. So I got a couple more of her sort of journalist, autobiographical journal type books that I'm very excited to read.
I was sort of waiting for Paul at the end to go, and I have the only copy of this book.
That's right.
Yeah.
the one copy exists in the Grand Rapids Public Library, so good luck. Get on the waiting list, yeah.
Cool. Well, for me this week, I didn't read too much. I managed to sit down and I read Hinterkind Volume 1. That's been sitting on my shelf for months and months and months, and I finally actually sat down and read it. I really enjoyed it. I probably will pick up the subsequent volumes. I think I've heard enough positive reviews of it. It was okay. It was a good, weird fantasy story. Kind of reminded me of Sweet Tooth a little bit, which I like. So I really want to know more about some of the characters they established in that book, so I'll probably grab the subsequent volumes. I also read a Comixology Submit book called Killbox, which is, I hate to say this, but it's like a Hunger Games Battle Royale-style story where the house, quote-unquote, the house, finds these people from all over the world, and they bring them in to fight each other to the death, and people place bets on them, and you can watch everything that's happening as they kill each other online, but it's within this like 4-mile by 4-mile grid anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world. And in this story, it happens to be taking place in Los Angeles. It's really gruesome. Like, it's, as a comic book, I'm kind of just like, yeah, death, violence, gambling, people are corrupt, yada, yada, yada. But like,
I've seen this all before.
Right, but when you think about like, if that was a real thing, I kind of like, my stomach turned when I read the book, and I was like, this is actually incredibly dark, way darker than I thought it was going to be. So it wasn't bad by any means. I might try to pick up the second issue, but I was really just kind of put off by just how gruesome it was. So if you're not really into murder and gambling and, you know, battle royale style awfulness where people are killing each other for, you know, sport, maybe this isn't for you. But if that is your bag, you know, check this book out.
If that's your jam,
and it's, you know, it's cheap, it's a Comixology Submit book, so, you know, go grab it for $1. It's not a bad read. It's worth at least trying number one. But the big thing that I read this past week was X-Men Age of Apocalypse Prelude, which is, so let me take a couple steps back. So a coworker of mine has decided, she's the host of the Comixology podcast, and she's decided that she's going to read all of the Apocalypse comics from the 90s in the, like, compiled versions on Comixology, leading up to the movie. So she's got X number of days before the movie comes out, and so she's trying to read as many comics as she can in that universe.
Good one.
Yeah, sorry. So I told her, hey, you know, I haven't read these books since I was probably in high school, which is, you know, well over almost 10 years ago, and I'm gonna try this with you. I'm going to try to keep up. And I read X-Men Age of Apocalypse Prelude, which is just a mix and mash of, like, 3 or 4 different X titles. There's, like, one issue of Cable, and then issues of Uncanny X-Men and X-Men and one other book that I can't remember. There's like, I think there's a one-shot in there. But it's essentially the story of Legion waking up from his coma that he's been in and going back in time because he realizes, oh, I can go back in time now because I'm a super mutant. And he's going to kill Magneto because Magneto has been the cause of all the problems in the X-Men world. And he figures if he kills Magneto, he'll save everything. And his father, you know, Charles Xavier, will be, you know, this great person who leads the mutants into a new world. Well, what ends up happening is he goes back in time, and as he goes to kill Magneto, since Charles Xavier and Magneto don't know who this Legion character is, and they only just barely know about mutants, Charles Xavier's like, oh no, my best friend, Magneto, who he calls Magnus. He's like, oh no, Magnus, and he jumps in front of the super mutant lightning strike or whatever that Legion shoots at Magneto, and he dies instead of Magneto. So Charles Xavier's dead, and at the end of the issue, Apocalypse goes, I've fought these X-Men before, but now I think I can strike again, and that leads into Age of Apocalypse somehow. So, like, the next volume picks up in the alternate universe, and we don't really know how that happened. So the story unfolds over four-issue miniseries telling the story of different pieces of the X-Men universe since Apocalypse took over. And I forgot how ridiculous 90s comics were. Oh my goodness, Cable is just this big brute of a man, larger than life, larger than any human should actually be. Bobby Drake as Iceman is just this mess of a human who's just crying and upset about everything in his life. And Mystique is awesome, and I forgot that she's awesome. And Gambit is smoking in every single panel. When they can, like, Gambit will,
like,
light
hot
a cigarette.
Or like,
like, he's smoking
cigarettes. Both.
And every panel where he's like, when they cut to him, even if it's in the middle of a conversation that he's in, he's lighting up a new cigarette. Like, every chance that they had, they would just put in a new cigarette in his mouth for him to smoke.
You just pay really close attention, and during one frame, it's actually Joe Camel.
Yeah. I mean,
wearing the trench coat and holding the staff.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it's, oh man, I was so blown away. And I actually found out, I was reading the credits, Mark Waid actually wrote some of the scripts for these stories, which I thought was really interesting. But nonetheless, it's, oh, I'm
you really, really ought to tweet him about it. I'm sure he would love to be reminded that he wrote that.
I'm really just excited to get back into the mess of this. I'm gonna try to read all of it before the movie comes out as well. So,
oh my god,
we'll see.
That might be fun, Mike. Because you know, oddly enough, I was reading this stuff when it came out. As someone who's never really liked the X-Men, but was reading Wizard magazine religiously, they were so up in hyping this event that I actually went out and bought it, and I remember nothing about it.
This is why you don't like the X-Men.
This is probably why I don't like the X-Men. Yeah. It probably is, because here I am, someone who's never really read X-Men comics, and I just jump on with this stuff. I was completely lost.
Oh, yeah. You know, this is the worst stuff to jump into. If you're ever trying to read X-Men, I would never give someone Age of Apocalypse and say, go for it, buddy, because I talk about how you need context going into things. Yeah. There, you need so much more going into Age of Apocalypse, because you need to know that they fought Apocalypse before. You need to know that Angel was at one point one of the horsemen. Like, there was already an Apocalypse fight before Age of Apocalypse. It's baffling. So that's going to be a fun ride.
You know that any book with Prelude in the title, you're in for a great time.
Yeah.
You're in for a real blast.
Well, too bad you can't.
Here's what you need to know in advance. By the way, here's what you need to know in advance is 600 pages.
Yeah. What you really need to do is to recreate the experience of reading it at the time is go to your local comic shop, go to the 50-cent or dollar bins and find all these issues. Hopefully you'll find the ones that I remember having that had the chromium embossed covers and the holographic, so only 90s kids would remember that comics used to have holograms on the covers, right?
Make sure this podcast is tagged with that. That way we get some of that BuzzFeed money.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyways, so let's talk about actual current comic books. So what are you guys excited for this upcoming week? Nick, we'll start with you again.
Well, it was sort of a really tough tie for me between Future Quest and Department H number 2, Future Quest number 1, Department H number 2. But then I saw that Paul was going to talk about Future Quest, and so why not at least plug a different book, even though Matt Kent doesn't need my help. So Department H number 2 obviously follows the very first issue, drawn and written by Matt Kent, and colored by his wife, Charlene Kent. This book, as Mike said last time, as I basically, you know, bugged him into reading, probably to a point neither of us were comfortable with. It's a fantastic book. Matt Kent's artwork is not for everybody, but if it's not for you, just stop comics, I guess. Maybe that's a little harsh, but it probably is actually. That was pretty harsh. But it was a fantastic read. I love that it's kind of like a mystery. I do like that Kent said that he does want this to be more straightforward and not as intricately, or I should say insanely layered as Mind Management was, which is not a knock on Mind Management. It was just a different type of book, and that's totally okay. It sounds like I'm giving the "it's not your fault" divorce, talk to the kid now. I really, really like this book. I really like that. And I don't know if they've made this clear with a lot of the people that are reading it, but it's actually like a perfectly planned 24 issues. And each issue covers the course of one day, because apparently, and I don't think this has been revealed at the end of issue one, or maybe this was jettisoned, but like some explosion goes off in this deep sea underwater facility, and they only have enough supplies and resources for 24 days to find a way off of the deep sea underwater base. And so each issue chronicles a single day. So it sounds like this thing is really well and really interestingly planned out. You don't find many creators that waltz in to do a series and they're like, yeah, this is going to be like 24 issues on the nose. Like, nobody does that anymore. Well, and not many people can throw their weight around to make that happen either.
But I mean, if they do, it's usually not like the one of the first bullet points you see about the series. I think this book has a specific chronological thing that's tied to it, and that makes that number so much more important. But anyways, Paul, what are you excited for this week?
Well, I mean, Nick already mentioned that I am very excited to read Future Quest number 1, the new DC series by Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner, who we've already praised. But this is a book that's based on the Hanna-Barbera cartoon properties that DC recently got the rights to. So I know they have the Scooby-Doo series. They're doing a new Flintstone series. Future Quest seems to be an amalgamation of a number of different properties. You have Space Ghost, you have Johnny Quest, you have the Herculoids, all cartoons that I have ephemeral fuzzy memories of seeing when I was a child. I don't have very fond memories of them. My memories are, you guys might be too young, but the USA Network used to have a TV show called USA Cartoon Express, and the opening was like a train going by. It was a Cartoon Express, and they would show all these old Hanna-Barbera cartoons on there. So that's how I remember this stuff. Wacky Races, Space Ghost, Herculoids, all that stuff.
The only yeah, Space Ghost not, stuff not I can think of bell. Is Space Ghost Coast to Coast on Adult right. Swim, and yes. I don't think that that's related.
No.
I think my parents deliberately messed with the TV to the point that it only played PBS, so I'm not really...
So you never got to watch Super Mutt? Or
I got to watch
Caveman,
Civil War.
Or, okay, well, there you go. So,
Ken Burns.
No, this was the Iron Man one.
Oh, okay.
PBS did a Ken Burns docudrama on okay, anyway. anyway. Coming full circle here.
Yeah.
10 minutes later.
Yeah. You know somewhere there's going to be someone doing Civil War reenactments, and then some idiot's going to show up dressed like Captain America. Like,
someone's going to tell the Iron Man costume.
What is all this?
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
For anyone who does this, and please do this, just take pictures. I really want
to
see this.
Send it to IRCB@destroythesive.org, and we will send you a free graphic novel of your choice.
Anyway, so here's a random grab bag of Hanna-Barbera cartoon properties that are all sort of vaguely futuristic sci-fi influenced, and I put all of my faith and trust in Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner to make a fantastic, fun, bright, adventure-filled comic book for me. As I mentioned, I love their Flash Gordon series, and this is basically like, I feel like this is going to hit that same exact button for me, where just a fun comic that I don't have to think too much about, but is well-crafted and looks beautiful. The preview images that they've done are fantastic. I actually know Darwin Cook did one of the variant covers for issue one, so hopefully I can find that. I'm just excited for this book. Like I said, Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner are probably two of my favorite creators right now. So anytime you get them together, I'll throw down my money for that.
Man, I'm going to have to try this book this week.
Yeah. No, I read in the interview with Doc Shaner that he said that like Darwin Cook's big contribution was that they sort of brought him on board to basically do what he did for DC with New Frontier, to more or less recreate the exact same sort of scenario or bringing everything together for Hanna-Barbera. So I guess
okay.
He said that even though, you know, his name isn't written and, you know, written down as one of the co-writers or anything like that, they said that he was like the big consulting force on setting this thing up in the first place. So
interesting.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, what I'm excited for this week is another DC book called American Alien. This is number 7, which is the last issue of this series of Max Landis's very weird, wacky run on a Superman story that's actually about Clark Kent and him becoming the Superman, you know. And this issue is illustrated by Jock, which is going to be really exciting. And, I mean, they've had an all-star cast of artists throughout this whole series, so I'm loving it. I can't wait to see the final showdown, I guess, between Clark Kent and Lex Luthor, which they've been slowly building in this series. Like, Clark Kent has run into Lex Luthor a couple of times. Like, even once when he was pretending to be Bruce Wayne, you know, Lex Luthor saw right through that. He's like, I know you're not Bruce Wayne, but I will still talk to you as if you are Bruce Wayne, which is a fantastic moment in, I think, issue 3 or 4. Nonetheless, this is going to be a fantastic issue. I can't say anything else other than that. I know everyone doesn't like Max Landis or something, but he knows how to write a good comic book, and he knows how to write Superman as a human. And that's the best part about this whole series, is he's just a regular guy, and he just happens
much
to be
unlike
Superman.
Max Landis.
Yeah, I guess if that's the route you want to go down, that's fine. But I still think that this is worth checking out. Like, even if you have a remote interest in Superman, or you don't have a remote interest in Superman, I think like this is a comic book that will make you see Superman in a different light, and I think that's what makes this series so great.
That's interesting. I mean, as someone who loves Superman pretty much unconditionally, the Max Landis name on this book kind of prevented me from buying it, but I've heard nothing but good things, so I will eventually check it out.
Definitely.
You know, Superman, yeah, so I'm cautiously optimistic based on what I've heard both from you, Mike, and from other people. I'm excited to check it out.
So for this week's episode, I wanted to talk to you guys about a topic that I think has come up multiple times in different episodes that we've never actually sat down and had a long, in-depth discussion about, and that's all-ages comics and what is considered like an all-ages comic. I think like a perfect example right now from the big two, which I know we're going to talk about in a moment, but is something like Gotham Academy, which is a book that isn't necessarily aimed at mature readers, it's not necessarily aimed at young readers, it's just a solid story that is applicable and readable by anyone who's interested in comic books. But that label all ages, or what people consider an all ages book, doesn't necessarily always mean all ages. A lot of the times it will mean, you know, kid friendly, which is a totally different thing. It's a totally different like mentality and way of telling a story. So I know you guys have some strong thoughts, so I will just leave it open there. Like, whoever wants to take over, run with it.
Sure. No, I think one of the biggest issues with this all ages label is that it's frequently used to basically mean you can hand this book to someone who is 6, you can hand this book to someone who is 99, not 100, don't give it to them, they don't, you know, you always see that, you know, this is for 6 to 99, fuck you if you made it to 3 digits. No.
Yeah.
But it's just this idea that if you're like 6 or if you're 99, you can be given this book, and A, you'll be capable of reading it, B, you probably won't be offended by it, and more or less you won't find any objectionable material. And that is what all ages means, I think, for a lot of books, which is unfortunate because that's not a guarantee that the book is enjoyable for anyone, really. So I think that's really the first misstep with that label, is just that it just really means that there's something out there that's going to be non-objectionable and, you know, capable of being read by all ages. That's it.
Yeah, I think the distinction here is the mistake some publishers might make is to think that by all ages, it has to be aimed at children or at kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is with that, kids are not dumb. And if something is being dumbed down to appeal to them, they can see right through it. I'm not a child, nor do I have children, but I'm assuming that most kids can kind of see through that and they want stuff that is engaging, right? So I know that in the past, comics aimed at kids tended to be dumb, and I think that is changing. The problem is, how do you market that? How do you market an all-ages book without saying, like, hey, it's for kids, turning off adult readers, or saying, hey, it's for kids, and dumbing it down so that kids don't like it? You know, and I think Gotham Academy, which is a book that I know I've talked about on the show, and Nick, I know you talked about reading, is I think it strikes that balance pretty well and is a good example of that. It's a book that anyone that with a passing knowledge of Batman or Gotham could read and enjoy. You don't have to be an expert in the continuity to enjoy it. And it's a book that I think pretty much anybody could have fun reading. It's not aimed at kids, nor is it dumbed down. And it's a fantastic book. And I think it's interesting to see there's fewer and fewer of those from the big two. And that seems to be the biggest example.
Yeah. I was trying to rack my brain, you know, before we started this, thinking, you know, what are the big two books that we can point at? And the names that always come up are, you know, Squirrel Girl, the Squirrel Girl series, which is, you know, widely celebrated as far as my Twitter feed and internet browsing history goes, and Gotham Academy. Those seem to be the two that everyone goes, yeah, anybody could pick this book up and enjoy it because it's a lot of fun. Like, there's no dark and gritty side to it. Maybe there's strife, there's, you know, internal issues. People are, you know, fighting with their parents, fighting with their friends, you know, they have a dilemma in school, they have something that everyone, or at least most people, you know, in Western culture can kind of relate to. And Miss Marvel's another book. I don't want to forget that one, because that's probably the bigger one that I actually read and enjoy.
Yeah.
But it's still, like, these are books that have a lot of, like, they have a lot of problems that a lot of people can relate to. Even a book like Miss Marvel, where like her struggles tends to be, you know, more oriented towards, you know, her cultural background. But at the same time, I can relate, you know, I fought with my parents. I've wanted to do something that my parents said I couldn't do. And I went out and did it anyways. And I got in trouble because of it, you know, or it turns out I was right and my parents were wrong. And that's like a success on multiple levels. So I think a lot of people can relate to these books, that, and that's what makes them truly all ages. You know, whether you're 14 or you're 54, like you go, oh yeah, I remember a time where that happened. I can relate to that character. And I think that's probably the key difference compared to like a kid oriented book. Like there were the old Spider-Man books that were really cartoony looking that came out.
Yeah,
I think it was like The Adventures of Spider-Man. And it's really, really just, like you said, Paul, dumbed down stories. And there's nothing you can really relate to. You're just kind of laughing and having fun with Peter Parker, but it's not compelling storytelling. And I think that's where what the balance we're trying to strike. Like it's fun and optimistic, but it's also got a good story to it. And I think that's the issue.
Yeah, and that can be tough. I think it's tough for the big two publishers to really do, because they have to appeal to their older readers. And I think it always comes out, you know, when they do these studies, that the majority of comic book readers, or the average comic book reader, is somewhere between 35 and 50, you know, right. Not kids.
Yeah.
So you have to have a book that not only a kid could pick up, so it has to be outside of continuity, but it has to be something that maybe an older reader could pick up and enjoy. And that's a tough balance to make. And on top of all that, it has to be profitable. And that seems to be the toughest hurdle for these books to make, is
right.
to actually sell enough copies to justify being published.
Yeah, and I think what's really genius about something like Gotham Academy, and obviously some of the other books that Mike mentioned that belong to Marvel,
those
so
Marvel
I'm actually
books.
Not legally allowed to name them, is that like it's not so often it seems like with a kid's book, like, it's this is the Batman for you book. Like, this is the Batman Junior book. Or this is the kid version of what adults get to read book. And it, as Paul said, kids aren't dumb. They don't want to feel like someone is just, like, super catering to them, or, you know, talking down to them. Or that they're getting the crappy version of a much more, you know, superior product. Kids know this stuff. Kids are awful. So I think that's what Gotham Academy does so well, is that it's like, here's a book that's actually somewhat kind of a little bit canon, and actually it has done tie-ins to other books, so technically yeah, it's canon. And yet it isn't like, this is the Batman Junior story, or this is like the Robin, you know, story. It's a totally separate book that kids feel that they can, you know, really enjoy and possess, and not feel like they're getting, you know, the hand-me-down or the second-rate product. It's something that's on equal standing and exists within the same world as the other books that, you know, they're not reading. And I think that's really important. That's super, you know, a well way of handling things. And as Paul was saying, on a profitability scale, it means you actually have a chance of also attracting the adults that also don't want to feel like they're reading, you know, the Batman Junior book. Who the heck wants that?
Exactly. No one does. But outside of the big two, though, you know, what other kinds of books are we looking at that are, you know, all ages friendly, that are, you know, appealing to us who are no longer between the ages of, you know, 10 and 18, and is like, but it's also like it's like a good compelling story, but it's not like overt with like sexuality or violence or anything like that. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for me is Lumberjanes, and I don't even read that book, but I know that book is a good story for some people. Like, it's not my cup of tea, but you can't like argue with a large vocal amount of people that are saying this is a really, really, really good book, and it's still selling and it's still doing well. So other than that, though, do you guys have anything that comes to mind?
Well,
oh, sure.
Bandette is the book that sprung to mind for me, because it is a beautiful comic book. It's a beautiful comic book. It is about a teenage girl who's a cat burglar. It's fun. It's funny. Unfortunately, it comes out somewhat irregularly, and it's digital first. And I think the hardcover collections are a little pricey, so it might be hard to justify for, you know, a new reader. But I love that book, and it is a book that is smart and whimsical without feeling forced, if that makes sense. It doesn't try too hard to be that. It is just fun naturally. And I think that's a book that I can imagine any type of comic book reader enjoying. So Bandette would be one I would suggest.
Yeah, I actually just saw the trade, like the softcover collected edition of that at Midtown this past weekend, or two weekends ago for Free Comic Book Day. Yeah. I think it was like $12.99 or $14.99 or something like that for four or five issues. So that's not, it's not too bad.
I know that other publishers are doing that type of stuff. I know that First Second is publishing a lot of all ages books. And what's really interesting is that they're getting creators that aren't known for doing that to try it. I know that Paul Pope did that Battling Boy comic, and I think there's been a second volume of that since the first one came out. But that's a book that was designed for a younger reader, and I remember reading it and thinking, maybe I'm just out of touch, but I didn't feel like a kid-friendly comic in a way. It was kind of dark and violent, but I should give kids more credit. I imagine there's people that kids that would really enjoy that book. So
it just turns out Battling Boy is actually not meant for children at all. And here's Paul telling everyone.
Yeah.
The man wrote Batman Year 100. I mean, come on.
Come on, right. It's got to be good.
It can't be safe for kids.
I did really enjoy
it. As you said, Bandette's written by the guy who writes Colder. So
right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
thinking of another book that, you know, we talk about on this show all the time. I think Transformers versus G.I. Joe is an all ages book. I wouldn't say that it's so violent and so crazy that like anyone couldn't understand it, because quite honestly, every single issue is like a new adventure into this weird world. And if you like either of those franchises, I think you're going to enjoy that book no matter how old you are. Like, I think I could hand this to like a 13-year-old kid and say, "Hey, read this. You like Transformers," and they would get a kick out of it, because it's all their Transformers fighting against, you know, the what are they? I don't even know all the names.
Decepticons.
Thank you. Autobots versus Decepticons. And oh yeah, by the way, G.I. Joe and America and everyone's doing things that you probably see in a cartoon that you think of when you think of G.I. Joe. So, I mean, I'm just going to throw that one out there because we love that book on this show.
At worst, your average kid would be no more lost when it comes to that book than I am.
Yeah, exactly.
And it seems it's a lot more approachable to a new or younger reader than the ongoing Transformers books would be, right? When they're so dense with continuity.
Yeah, well,
so I think, yeah.
As a person who's only read one volume of the ongoing, I've read the first volume of More Than Meets the Eye, and not knowing anything about that series, that too is another kid-friendly book, or not kid-friendly, but all-ages book, because I love it, but it's just straight up Transformers being Transformers, doing Transformer things in a Transformer universe. Like, what else do you want out of a Transformers book? There's no overt sexual overtones, like the violence is no more like violent than the movies or the cartoons were. So, I mean, I should say not the movies, the live action, but the cartoon movies. So it's Transformers doing Transformers things, and those books are killer.
Okay. When IDW comes out with the Transformers book that does include overt sexual overtones, let me know. Please.
Speaking of IDW, I do want to give a shout out to Gem and the Holograms, which is another sort of franchise book based on a 80s cartoon property that I think a contemporary modern kid could pick up and really enjoy. I think the right age group would really enjoy that, even if they have no knowledge of the original source material. So that's another book that is aimed at, I want to say, you know, like preteen, teenage girls, and that's a neglected market for comic books. I think as someone that remembers the cartoon, I really enjoy it as a 33-year-old man.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think when we were going to find a trend here, if we talk about any of these licensed books, 9 times out of 10, they're going to be, you know, all ages. Or aimed at a younger audience, at least initially, where, you know, this new Future Quest and all the Scooby-Doo and all the Hanna-Barbera, you know, books, those are all going to be all ages types of books. Maybe they're geared towards a younger audience, but I think the quote-unquote nostalgia factor will rope in a lot of people who are of that, you know, classic comic book demographic who said, oh yeah, I watched those cartoons, I enjoyed those properties when they were coming out, so I'm going to buy the comic. And I think that's good because they're new takes, they're fresh eyes, fresh takes on these types of books. Ultimately, I mean, fingers crossed these types of things will do well, even if it is just DC cashing in a little bit.
Yeah, and I think with the nostalgia factor, I think that's a really strong starting point for creating a true all-ages book, because you obviously rope in the parent or the, you know, the adult with the nostalgia factor of, you know, maybe something they watched in the 70s or 80s, and then, you know, they can pass that down to their kid and say, you know, this is what I grew up with, and wasn't my childhood awful? No, I'm just kidding. And, you know, I hope this is something I can share with you. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, it's not an all ages book. Literally, you know, I think there needs to be that sort of idea that, you know, a parent can read it and give it to their kid and both can, you know, enjoy it or talk about it and, you know, have that shared moment. Cause that's, you know, that's what I remember so much with, you know, when I was growing up, you know, even like with movies or whatever, you know, watching Indiana Jones with my dad, which, I mean, I guess it's debatable whether or not that was all ages. I guess for me it was, but you know, it's just having that shared experience. And I think that's a big part of it too.
Totally.
I mean, we have an obligation to, you know, this was my mini soapbox I was thinking about is that, you know, in this day and age, we talk a lot about, you know, the prominent cause, and it's a valid cause, and it deserves to be at the forefront of you know, campaigning for is the idea that we want people of color and of different genders and other various viewpoints to have representation in comics, and that's important, and that's valid, and it deserves to be right at the top. But this whole idea of creating comics for kids, it seems like it's sort of on the back burner, maybe because kids don't have money. Get on it, kids. Yeah. And that sucks because, as Paul said, like, there's no denying the fact that the average reader of comics is getting older. Like, they're not, it's not even staying at that, you know, age that it's at. Like, the average age of comic book readers is getting older and older because it's just that same generation just getting older and older. And if comics are to survive, we need a new, you know, a ground swelling, you know, a grassroots, you know, campaign of getting young kids to read comics. Otherwise, what the heck is going to happen in 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I, you know, based on my limited understanding of the overall market, it really seems like the publishers that are thinking that forwardly are not Marvel and DC.
Oh, absolutely.
It's publishers like Image and IDW.
Well, they'll tell you that they already make books for kids. Kids can read Superman, right? Kids can read Batman, right? I'm not joking. That's what they'll, I'm sure that's what they'd tell you, because they don't, for the most part, they don't want to dip their, you know, their toes in that pool of water. That's not something they're interested in, and I'm sure they see it as a risk.
But I think
they'll tell you their books are for kids already.
But I still think we're seeing a shift, though. Like Paul is saying, you know, we've got, you know, these smaller publishers, you know, even Boom, you know, Oni Press, and Image to a small extent, you know, they're dipping their toes in that pool because they need to find another demographic that they can appeal to that isn't being tapped already by the big two. So by publishing books like Giant Days or Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, you know, we're seeing things specifically at Boom where they're trying tremendously to grab that market because, you know, they've got, you know, Adventure Time, they've got regular show, they've got all those cartoons.
Bee and Puppycat,
exactly. And those are books that like younger audiences want to read, but they're still really good for people who are older. Like, those are still books that I want to read because they're very well written, they're very well crafted. I mean, Giant Days in specific, I have the trade of that. I've sat down and read the first issue. Like, that book is killer, but it's definitely not aimed at my demographic, but I really, really like it. So I would gladly give that book to someone who is younger, maybe just getting out of high school, going into college, saying, hey, check out this book. You could totally relate to it because it's about, you know, four girls that go to college together and the craziness that happens there. I mean, it's a slice of life book, so it's a little bit different. It's not your big two superheroes fighting each other and stuff like that, but it's it's still a type of book that will bring in an untapped market.
And I think what's interesting about some of these books, these newer ones that are showing up on the scene, is that they're finding new ways to engage with kids in preparation for this. Yes, I do actually prepare things sometimes. I read the first volume of Bee and Puppycat, and it was really, really interesting because halfway through this comic, the two main characters who are named Bee and Puppycat, obviously, they end up getting sent on this mission to fix a music box. And the problem is they end up in a room with a ton of music boxes and they can't figure out which one they're supposed to fix. And what's really neat is you have these really colorful, ornately designed music boxes. And then when the music box opens, there's a little bubble above it with a QR code. And you can click on the QR code with your phone and listen to the music that comes out of the music box.
No way.
To try to figure out which one of them is broken.
What? That is... Yeah. I'm going to say this because it's ridiculous, but that is so far out. That is awesome. Like, that is...
That's great.
Oh, I love that kind of stuff. That's the type of stuff that is gimmicky, but in the right way. Okay, sorry. That's
yeah, that's no, awesome. And that's like this idea of integrating technology and giving people, you know, kids and other level of, you know, interactivity. I think this is something obviously that kid readers look more forward to or are expecting more than your average like 48-year-old guy that reads Superman. He is not eager to dig out his phone and go figure out what the fuck a QR reader is. But kids look at that stuff. I'm sure, you know, they find that really, really interesting and fascinating. And it's that kind of new ways of engaging, you know, kid readers, even at the comic book level, that I think is going to really help the industry in the future, for sure. I found that just amazing. I mean, credit, you know, tip of the hat to Boom. Another one that I think I would definitely recommend is IDW somehow got the rights. I don't know how they pulled this off. They got the rights to, like, all of the Disney comics that were prominently only published in Europe. So, like, the Donald Duck that was in Europe and, you know, the Mickey Mouse and all of that. And that stuff is great. That stuff is a lot of fun. It reminds me so much of Tintin, which is another one that I would say, aside from that one book that was, like, banned because it was, like, racist or whatever, but you can't get your hands on it, so you couldn't read it even if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. Tintin. Oh, my goodness. Tintin. Oh, all ages. Absolutely. Yeah. I love that book.
Well, yeah. In that same vein, I mean, you look at, that's a property that's been alive for a really long time, and Archie is the exact same way. Archie is all ages forever and then some, outside of, you know, their weirdo books, like the, what was it, Black Mask or Black something, I can't remember, that Dwayne Straczynski was writing in their Afterlife with Archie. Right.
Black Hood.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Black Hood.
And there's some, you know, Spectacular Sabrina or something, I don't know. The Sabrina book and the Afterlife with Archie book, those are like super horror books. But those two books aside, I mean, everything that they're doing, even the modern Jughead and Archie runs that are being put out right now by Chip Zdarsky and Mark Waid on writing, respectively, those books are super all ages. I love those books, and I guarantee you if I gave them to a 15-year-old kid, they'd love them even more because, you know, they get all the references the same way that I do, and I'm just trying to keep up. So
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Funny aside here really quick about the Jughead's book. I learned about this past week. All of the in-jokes that they're doing in that series, if you read that book at all, about, like, the super Archie friends or, like, the alternate city where everyone is swapped genders or whatever, those are just plays on old Archie and Jughead stories. I didn't know that. I thought that was really cool. So longtime Archie fans will actually get a little gem in their comic book if they're reading the current Archie and current Jughead books. So just a little aside there.
Yeah, all of that on top of the fact that Archie, like I think every single issue of Archie right now has an actual classic Archie strip.
Yeah, same with the Jughead book.
Or actual comic. It's not just a strip, it's a full-fledged comic at the back.
Yeah.
And yeah, I find that interesting. And exactly, these are the kind of books that I think kids would really like and really enjoy. And of course, this requires a certain level of, like, you know, parental interest to figure out that you can't just hand your kid, you know, Batman because you know that, like, it's DC, you know, so no Batman book is going to get worse than, like, PG-13 at most or whatever. Like, it's not just about the maturity level with books like that. It's about the fact that dropping your kid into, like, complicated plot lines and storylines, like, that's... And then any book that has, like, tie-ins, like, you can't have a kid reading that. They're not going to want that.
Right. Totally.
Maybe.
Ultimately, it sounds like there are a lot of all-ages books, at least to our knowledge, right? Like, we definitely know these things exist. I think the question is, like, are these books selling well? Or what could we do more to, you know, push these books as, you know, comic book patrons? You know, is it just reading them? Or is it when you recommend a book to somebody, which, you know, we've talked about many, many times, you know, do you start them with an all-ages book like this to say, you know what, here's an easy dive into comics. I know you've never read comic books before, so take this book. It's not Superman, it's not Batman, it's not X-Men, but it's something that you could easily read and enjoy and not have to worry about continuity or anything like that. It's just an initial, like, good story that you can, like, get your feet wet in. And then after that, if you want to dive deeper, then we can figure that out. Would you say that that's probably true?
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of these franchise books are working so well as all-ages books, is that the uncertainty and, you know, the sort of apprehension about, like, well, it's not Batman, it's not Superman, well, then, like, what are you trying to give me, right? Like, what is this book, then? The idea that sometimes you have, like, an 80s franchise or something attached to it sort of makes things a little more palatable or makes it much more of an easy entry point. over something like Giant Days, where it's like, well, can you explain this to me? Well, it's kind of like a comic about sort of just normal life.
Yeah.
Okay, sign me up. You really sold me now.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the key is having a hook for the book, like something recognizable in it that would attract an older, jaded reader like myself, but also something that is new and fresh for kids. And I think that's where, like I mentioned, Gem and the Holograms is so successful. It's something I enjoyed, but it feels so different in aesthetics than the cartoon while still capturing the spirit of it. You know, and then like Bandette is such a beautiful book. If you like comic books at all as an art form, you should be poring over every page of that book. At the same time, a younger reader would just have a lot of fun with it. So it's a difficult balance, but when it works, I think they really are books that work for everyone of all ages, right?
Yeah. I think what's great about this is that we are able to talk about the number of books that are out there that are like great starts. So we'll try to make a list or something and put it in the show notes. So if anyone's interested in any of these books, I'll go through and maybe come up with a few that choice ones that we think are probably great with Amazon links and all that crazy stuff. So you can actually go out and buy them or find them at your local shop. So,
and if there's any that we missed that you think we'd enjoy, send them our way.
Yes.
We'd love to get recommendations.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
Unless they suck.
Right.
In which
I don't
case,
want those. I read enough of those as is.
Yeah.
I read enough shitty books on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't need you telling me what shitty books to read.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Atmosphere and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Atmosphere on Bandcamp at atmosphere.bandcamp.com, and you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.com. Mike and I were interviewed on Podcast Fiend, the show of a friend of ours, Jeff Perry. He asks us about our history with our podcast, our process for creating an episode, and some of the hurdles we encountered in recording and editing. Check it out at podcastfiend.com. You can find more of this podcast at our website, ircb.us, or through the podcatcher of your choice. Remember, if you enjoy this show, tell someone about it. Rate us online, or write to us. Send us your all-ages book recommendations at ircb@destroythesybe.org. The entire podcast team is on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. You can also join the discussions on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And again, from all of us here at the podcast, thanks for listening.